Chinese people keep trying to push the ideas of justice and human dignity in China.
Chinese Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo dies. It's Friday, July 14th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online right now on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, there's much reaction to the death of Liu Xiaobo. India is concerned with Chinese activity near Bhutan. South Korean trade to be discussed, understanding brush fires, and apes return to the movies. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Chinese human rights prisoner Liu Xiaobo died Thursday at age 61 following a high-profile battle with liver cancer that made his death as controversial as his life. Liu, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate who spent his last 8 years as a prisoner of conscience, passed away at a hospital in Shenyang, China, where he had been moved from his prison cell in the final stages of his illness. Heather Nauert is a State Department spokesperson.
As you saw from the statement that the Secretary issued today, we join those in China and around the world in mourning the tragic passing of the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize laureate Liu Xiaobo, who died while serving a lengthy prison sentence in China for promoting peaceful democratic reform. Mr. Liu dedicated his life to the betterment of his country and humankind and to the pursuit of justice and liberty. Our heartfelt condolences go out to his wife, Liu Xia, and all of his loved ones. We continue to call on the Chinese government to release her from house arrest and allow her to depart China according to her wishes. In his fight for freedom, equality, and constitutional rule in China, Liu Xiaobo embodied the human spirit that the Nobel Peace Prize rewards. In his death, he has only reaffirmed the Nobel Committee's selection.
Liu Xiaobo's final days were marked by a public dispute over the quality of his care and Beijing's refusal of a family request that he be transferred for treatment to the United States or Germany. Liu's reputation as an outspoken dissident had deep roots. In his brief government-sanctioned role as a popular writer and college lecturer, he was known for his criticism of traditional Chinese culture and for urging his fellow literati to exhibit more individualism. His promising career took a drastic turn in the spring of 1989 when he cut short a visiting scholarship at Columbia University in New York City and returned home to join student-led protests in Tiananmen Square. Following a violent crackdown known by Chinese as the June 4th massacre, Liu was jailed for 2 years. In 2008, Liu and other dissidents and intellectuals issued a document known as Charter 08, which calls for an end to China's one-party system and establishment of a new republic comprising of a federation of regions and political communities with genuine participation from the public. I spoke earlier with Andrew Nathan, a political science professor at Columbia University, about the impact of Liu Xiaobo's death.
I think it's a blow to China's prestige in the West, but I don't think it's going to have any impact on the Chinese regime. Liu Xiaobo is not really well known inside of China, and I suppose that the information about his illness and his death is not very widely known in China either. So I guess the regime will just continue on to the upcoming 19th Party Congress without any disturbance. So they want to show themselves to be tough and firm. They want to show that to their domestic audience and to the international audience as well. And I guess they've showed it.
Is there a repercussion for China with Liu's passing and the fact that China seemed to show very little compassion for his care and allowing him to leave the country?
I don't think there's going to be any substantial international repercussion. Everybody's going to deplore, foreign governments have expressed different degrees of diplomatic language that they deplore the fact that Liu Xiaobo wasn't, you know, that his cancer wasn't caught earlier and that he wasn't allowed to get the medical care overseas that he expressed he wanted to have. So the governments have said things. The U.S. government has issued a statement already, and I think the Norwegian government has issued a statement. But these statements, that's the end of it, I think. The statements are in varying degrees mild and diplomatic, and there won't be any punishment after that for the Chinese government.
There is concern, of course, for his wife and other family members who remain in China. Will there be any possibility that at some point they may be able to leave?
I guess that it is possible that the government will allow the wife and her brother, those are the people involved, to leave. They've expressed a desire to, I don't know now whether they want to leave, but in the past they've expressed that desire, and I think she may still want to leave. And I think it's possible that the government will let her leave, because when the Chinese government allows a dissident to leave, that person goes into exile and becomes much less influential. That's been the experience before. They're cut off from the public in China, which was already the case with Liu Xia, but they also stop being such a sort of sore case for the international community. There's a sense in which their situation has been solved. They've been freed. So they come overseas and they have a hard time usually adjusting and finding a role overseas. So exile, from the point of view of Beijing, is not that bad a thing. And so they may very well let her go.
Are there effective ways that human rights groups can carry on Liu Xiaobo's banner, if you will, beyond his passing?
He said himself in one of his writings how important it is for people inside China who are struggling for human rights, human dignity, to hear the voice of support from overseas, even though that voice of support from overseas is just a voice and it's just moral support. I think that the human rights groups overseas can't really make anything happen in China, but they can. It's amazing but true that Chinese people keep trying, small numbers but brave people keep trying to push the ideas of justice and human dignity in China. So I'm sure that they will continue to be Chinese doing that, and it's important for the outside world to continue to express respect and support for those people.
Andrew Nathan, professor of political science at Columbia, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Liu Xiaobo is survived by a son and his wife of 21 years, Liu Xia. More on reaction to Liu Xiaobo's death in just a moment on VOA Asia. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Liu Xiaobo, Nobel Peace Prize winner, dies in Chinese hospital. Rights groups, Nobel Commission express regret over Liu's death. Four policemen killed in terrorist attack in southwest Pakistan. China posts double-digit trade increase with North Korea in first half of 2017. China reducing massive influence of social media celebrities. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, and do stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. There have been many statements and comments on the passing of Chinese Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is calling for China to release his widow from house arrest. Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona told VOA he puts the responsibility of Liu's death on the government in Beijing.
It's a tragedy. It's a ruling clique in Beijing is responsible for his death. It's another in the list of outrages that I believe clearly indicate that the regime ruling China is anti-democratic.
U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat from Connecticut, says he hopes the passing of Liu Xiaobo will help to lead to more openness in China.
We should be demanding of China to open its doors to greater human rights and liberties and protect people when they are dissidents, and also be wary of the threat that China may pose in parts of the world where human rights and liberties are at risk.
The leader of the Norwegian Nobel Committee said Thursday the Chinese government bore a heavy responsibility for Liu's death. We find it, quote, deeply disturbing that Liu Xiaobo was not transferred to a facility where he could receive adequate medical treatment before he became terminally ill, said Berit Riis-Anderson in an emailed statement. Rights groups were quick to praise Liu Xiaobo's achievements and legacy while calling on the international community to investigate deaths in captivity and work to prevent them. Democrat Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland says human rights extends beyond China and the United States should champion those principles, whether it applies to China or elsewhere.
You know, human rights is a global issue. It's not one country. We all have responsibilities to preserve the human rights of the people of our country and to speak out when other countries deny the basic rights to its citizens. In China's case, they have denied the rights to many of their citizens, and we speak out, and I think the international community will speak out.
Many comments have been posted on Sina Weibo, China's largest microblog service about Nobel Peace Laureate Liu Xiaobo's death, including a user with the name Butterfly in the Headwind, who said, quote, once a prisoner, his soul has been freed. Behind his towering stature is hundreds of millions of well-wishers bidding him goodbye. Although he has burnt out the candle of life, his generous thoughts and deeds will one day shine over China's soil. A user with the name Old and New Prince said, quote, why do we remember him? Because he died for every one of us and fought for our human rights. What did he seek? He sought after what Chinese citizens are losing every day. A user with the name Beijing Lehi said, quote, we can choose to kowtow to authorities, but deep down in our heart, we cannot let someone who lit up the soul of freedom and died for his ideals to leave this world in loneliness. Our thanks to intern Harry Chen for gathering these comments. Let us know what you think by posting a message on VOA Asia Facebook, or you can send us an email at voaasia@voanews.com. Happening now in Asia, a Japanese patrol vessel was chased by an armed fishing boat believed to be from North Korea. Tokyo filed a formal protest with Pyongyang. No one was hurt in the incident. Japanese news agencies say the waters are rich squid fishing areas where North Korean boats often operate illegally. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. A tense standoff between India and China in the high Himalayas is being played out not on the disputed borders between the two Asian giants, but on a plateau claimed by China and Bhutan. Many analysts say the face-off is also a play for power in the tiny, strategically located country, which is India's closest ally in South Asia, but where Beijing wants to increase its presence. Indian troops obstructed a Chinese road-building project last month in an area very strategic for India because it connects the country's mainland to its northeastern region. New Delhi cites its treaties with Bhutan, with which it has close military and economic ties, for keeping its soldiers in the area despite strident calls by Beijing to vacate the mountain region. As the standoff drags on, there are fears in New Delhi that Beijing is also testing its ties with Bhutan, the tiny nation that has made gross national happiness its mantra, but where worries are growing about a big power conflict on its doorstep. Analysts like Manoj Joshi, a strategic affairs analyst at the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi, point out that China wants to wean Bhutan away from India and expand ties with a country with which it has no diplomatic ties.
At a strategic level, China would like to separate India from Bhutan, and they would like to open up Bhutan to their influence, to greater influence. So that goes without saying.
According to a Bhutanese political analyst who did not want to be identified, it's not the first time the Chinese have built a road in a disputed area in Bhutan, which has a disputed border with China at several places in the high Himalayas.
Since the bar is high, that Indian side has to withdraw, and the Indian side has its own security objectives, concerns. That has not happened. Fortunately, nobody spoke about escalation to the military level.
Bhutan worries about being drawn into the rivalry between the two large neighbors and has maintained a steadied silence on the dispute, except to issue one statement calling on Beijing to restore the status quo in the area. While keeping the Chinese out of the strategic plateau is India's immediate concern, there is also concern about maintaining its influence in Bhutan, which is a buffer between China and India. India has watched warily as Beijing has steadily increased its presence in its neighborhood in recent years in countries like Bangladesh, Nepal, and Sri Lanka, which have also been increasingly drawn into the Chinese sphere of influence by the promise of massive investments in roads, ports, and other infrastructure. Manoj Jossi says there are concerns in India that the same should not happen in Bhutan, its most steadfast ally, saying the Chinese have been applying pressure on the Bhutanese border.
Bhutan would go the way of, let's say, Nepal or something like that, where Indian influence is questioned, you know, it would make a difference. That buffer would vanish.
India's foreign secretary this week expressed confidence that India and China have the maturity to handle their latest dispute and it will be handled diplomatically. But while in the past such border standoffs have been resolved quickly, this time around there are no signs the issue is getting resolved nearly a month after it erupted. Our thanks to Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi for contributing this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the Bank of Korea says South Korea's economy is likely to expand 2.8% this year over a year earlier, thanks to strong exports and robust capital spending by tech companies. If growth is as forecast, Asia's fourth largest economy will expand at its fastest pace in 3 years. Expand your global awareness every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. The Trump administration has informed South Korea that it wants to renegotiate their five-year-old free trade agreement. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer sent a letter Wednesday to his South Korean counterpart calling for a joint committee meeting to remove barriers to U.S. trade and consider needed amendments to the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, commonly known as CORUS. The talks will be held within the next 30 days as called for under the terms of the agreement. Lighthizer issued a statement saying the U.S. trade deficit in goods with South Korea has more than doubled, from $13.2 billion to $27.6 billion since taking effect in 2012. But some experts say the U.S. enjoys a trade surplus under the deal in areas like banking and tourism. South Korea's trade ministry said in a statement, the meeting does not imply that Seoul will agree to renegotiate the pact. It says the two sides must first determine whether CORUS is actually responsible for the trade imbalance. Developing at this hour in Asia, China says its trade with North Korea rose in the first 6 months of 2017 compared to the same period last year. The figures are likely to increase calls for Beijing to pressure Pyongyang, its main diplomatic and economic ally, to curb its nuclear and missile testing program. VOA Asia Facebook has the top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, each year wildfires around the world devastate thousands of square kilometers of forests and grasslands and make many people homeless. Some plants recover faster from fire than others, and scientists would like to know why. VOA's George Pudich tells us in Australia they're experimenting with simple monitoring devices to rely on fiber optics.
Due to Australia's mostly hot and dry climate, bushfires happen often, devastating both mountain forests and flat lands covered in grass and low brush. But certain native plants, such as Banksia, have evolved to quickly regrow after a fire. Scientists from Curtin University in Perth are trying to learn what makes them strong enough to survive the blaze.
Particularly in banks of woodlands where they're surrounded by people and places and infrastructure, so better understanding how management can implement fire policy and fire regimes in these systems is really important.
One of the factors is the temperature of soil at different depths. thin fiber optic lines laid at different depths under a layer of leaves and twigs can read the temperature of the soil and send it to a laptop computer.
We're just getting about 55 degrees in the soil, about 3 centimeters deep. We haven't approached the shallow stuff yet.
First readings showed that drier seeds have better survivability than those with higher moisture. Genetic researchers at Curtin University also discovered that Banksia did not adapt to wildfires themselves, but rather to the intensity and historic frequency of the blazes. With recent shorter fire cycles, the plants may not have enough time to produce viable seeds. Researchers say new findings will lead to better understanding of wildlife impacts on the Australian bush. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
All right, now, sometimes when you're sitting in a dark movie theater, you've heard it, a thunderous rumble from the theater next door. And if you plan to go this weekend, that rumble may likely be from the third installment of the new Planet of the Apes films that opens in U.S. theaters later today. As VOA Asia's David Berg tells us, war for the Planet of the Apes continues chimpanzee Caesar's evolution into a leader of his simian people.
You're Caesar. We've been searching for you for so long.
I do not start this war. I fight only to protect apes.
Motion capture actor Andy Serkis returns as Caesar, the chimp who has developed from a young ape into the leader in this third installment. Caesar fights to protect his family, and his attitudes toward humans continue to change in this film. Serkis, known also for his performance as Gollum in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit movies, says his character is beginning to take on the role he seems destined to assume.
Of course, in this one, Caesar, he's older. He's also evolving from being ape-like into more human-like, certainly in terms of his facial expressions, his thinking, his emotions, beginning to feel more human-like, and linguistically he begins to feel more human-like.
The film uses the latest in motion capture technology, something that director Matt Reeves says makes the most of the actors' performances.
The actors are there. I think what happens is a lot of people think, oh, well, you go and, you know, the people who are playing the human characters, they must be playing to tennis balls or something. The actors are there. So we shot in the snow, we shot in the rain, we shot in the freezing cold. Well, Andy Serkis and Steve Zahn, all of the actors, they were there in their mocap suits. So it sounds, the complex part of it is once you shoot actors in their mocap suits, getting everything else you need in order to make those shots come to life.
Woody Harrelson joins the story as Colonel McCulloch, a human who is obsessed with destroying the apes and especially their leader, Caesar. Harrelson says his character is not a cartoon villain, but a man who wants to save his race and his planet.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely not just a simple kind of cutout. I think there's a lot to what goes on with him. Couple things that were, that he didn't use that I kind of liked, a couple scenes. But, you know, you watch the final product and it's great.
Andy Serkis says this film has more emotional depth and complexity than previous movies, and he thinks that audiences will love it.
I think this is really powerful, this movie, and it's a very emotional film. I mean, last night watching it, people were literally crying, you know. So it's also got great humor in it. It's an epic. It's a mythic story. I think it's a brilliant blockbuster, which with heart and a lot of intelligence. So I think people will be moved by it and really care about the characters.
War for the Planet of the Apes is rated PG-13. It opens in U.S. theaters July 14th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, whether you're going to be taking in a movie or you have other plans, we're certainly glad you spent part of your day with us at VOA Asia. You can find us online at voanews.com and, of course, on Facebook at VOA Asia. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jim Harmon, managing editor, Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Byrd as part of our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.